patience with me, you know, because this sort of life is new to me. I've lived rather differently, and I do want to make a success of it, and above all to make Mr. De Winter happy. I know I can leave all household arrangements to you. Mr. De Winter said so, and you must just run things as they have always been run. I shan't want to make any changes. I stopped, a little breathless, still uncertain of myself and whether I was saying the right thing, and when I looked up again, I saw that she had moved and was standing with her hand on the handle of the door. "Very good," she said. "I hope I shall do everything to your satisfaction. The house has been in my charge now for more than a year, and Mr. De Winter has never complained. It was very different, of course, when the late Mrs. De Winter was alive. There was a lot of entertaining then, a lot of parties, and though I managed for her, she liked to supervise things herself." Once again I had the impression that she chose her words with care, that she was feeling her way, as it were, into my mind, and watching for the effect upon my face. "I would rather leave it to you," I repeated, "much rather," and into her face came the same expression I had noticed before, when first I had shaken hands with her in the hall, a look surely of derision, of definite contempt. She knew that I would never withstand her, and that I feared her too. "Can I do anything more for you?" she said, and pretended to glance round the room. "No," I said. "No, I think I have everything. I shall be very comfortable here. You have made the room so charming." This last, a final crawling sop to win her approval. She shrugged her shoulders, and still she did not smile. "I only followed out Mr. De Winter's instructions," she said. She hesitated by the doorway, her hand on the handle of the open door. It was as though she still had something to say to me, and could not decide upon the words, yet waited there for me to give her opportunity. I wished she would go. She was like a shadow standing there, watching me, appraising me with her hollow eyes, set in that dead skull's face. "If you find anything not to your liking, you will tell me at once," she asked. "Yes," I said. "Yes, of course, Mrs. Danvers." But I knew this was not what she had meant to say, and silence fell between us once again. "If Mr. De Winter asks for his big wardrobe," she said suddenly, "you must tell him it was impossible to move. We tried, but we could not get it through these narrow doorways. These are smaller rooms than those in the West Wing. If he doesn't like the arrangement of this suite, he must tell me. It was difficult to know how to furnish these rooms." "Please don't worry, Mrs. Danvers," I said. "I'm sure he will be pleased with everything, but I'm sorry it's given you so much trouble. I had no idea he was having rooms redecorated and furnished. He shouldn't have bothered. I'm sure I should have been just as happy and comfortable in the West Wing." She looked at me curiously, and began twisting the handle of the door. "Mr. De Winter said you would prefer to be on this side," she said. "The rooms in the West Wing are very old. The bedroom in the big suite is twice as large as this. A very beautiful room, too, with a scrolled ceiling. The tapestry chairs are very valuable, and so is the carved mantelpiece. It's the most beautiful room in the house, and the windows look down across the lawns to the sea." I felt uncomfortable, a little shy. I did not know why she must speak with such an undercurrent of resentment, implying as she did at the same time that this room, where I found myself to be installed, was something inferior, not up to Manderley standard, a second-rate room, as it were, for a second-rate person. "I suppose Mr. De Winter keeps the most beautiful room to show to the public," I said. She went on twisting the handle of the door, and then looked up at me again, watching my eyes, hesitating before replying. And when she spoke, her voice was quieter even, and more toneless than it had been before. "The bedrooms are never shown to the public," she said. "Only the hall and the gallery and the room below." She paused an instant, feeling me with her eyes. "They used to live in the West Wing and use those rooms when Mrs. De Winter was alive. That big room I was telling you about, that looked down to the sea, was Mrs. De Winter's bedroom." And I saw a shadow flit across her face, and she drew back against the wall, effacing herself, as a step sounded outside, and Maxim came into the room. "How is it?" he said to me. "All right? Do you think you'll like it?" He looked round with enthusiasm, pleased as a schoolboy. "I always thought this a most attractive room," he said. "It was wasted all those years as a guest room, but I always thought it had possibilities. You've made a great success of it, Mrs. Danvers. I give you full marks." "Thank you, sir," she said, her face expressionless. And then she turned and went out of the room, closing the door softly behind her. Maxim went and leant out of the window. "I love the rose garden," he said. "One of the first things I remember is walking after my mother on very small, unsteady legs while she picked off the dead heads of the roses. There's something peaceful and happy about this room, and it's quiet, too. You could never tell you were within 5 minutes of the sea from this room." "That's what Mrs. Danvers said," I told him. He came away from the window. He prowled about the room, touching things, looking at the pictures, opening wardrobes, fingering my clothes, already unpacked. "How did you get on with old Danvers?" he said abruptly. I turned away and began combing my hair again before the looking-glass. "She seems just a little bit stiff," I said after a moment or two. "Perhaps she thought I was going to interfere with the running of the house." "I don't think she would mind your doing that," he said. I looked up and saw him watching my reflection in the looking-glass, and then he turned away and went over to the window again, whistling quietly under his breath, rocking backwards and forwards on his heels. "Don't mind her," he said. "She's an extraordinary character in many ways, and possibly not very easy for another woman to get on with. You mustn't worry about it. If she really makes herself a nuisance, well, get rid of her. But she's efficient, you know, and will take all the housekeeping worries off your hands. I dare say she's a bit of a bully to the staff. She doesn't dare bully me, though. I'd have given her the sack long ago if she'd tried." "I expect we shall get on very well when she knows me better," I said quickly. "After all, it's natural enough that she should resent me a bit at first." "Resent you? Why resent you? What the devil do you mean?" he said. He turned from the window, frowning, an odd, half-angry expression on his face. I wondered why he should mind, and wished I had said something else. "I mean, it must be much easier for a housekeeper to look after a man alone," I said. "I dare say she'd got into the way of doing it, and perhaps she was afraid I should be very overbearing."
"Overbearing? My God," he began.
"If you think..." And then he stopped, and came across to me, and kissed me on the top of my head.
"Let's forget about Mrs. Danvers," he said. "She doesn't interest me very much, I'm afraid. Come along, and let me show you something of Manderley."
I did not see Mrs. Danvers again that evening, and we did not talk about her any more. I felt happier when I had dismissed her from my thoughts, less of an interloper, and as we wandered about the rooms downstairs and looked at the pictures, and Maxim put his arm around my shoulder, I began to feel more like the self I wanted to become, the self I had pictured in my dreams, who made Manderley her home. My footsteps no longer sounded foolish on the stone flags of the hall, for Maxim's nailed shoes made far more noise than mine, and the pattering feet of the two dogs was a comfortable, pleasing note. I was glad, too, because it was the first evening, and we had only been back a little while, and the showing of the pictures had taken time, when Maxim, looking at the clock, said it was too late to change for dinner, so that I was spared the embarrassment of Alice the maid asking what I should wear, and of her helping me to dress, and myself walking down that long flight of stairs to the hall, cold with bare shoulders, in a dress that Mrs. Van Hopper had given me because it did not suit her daughter. I had dreaded the formality of dinner in that austere dining-room, and now, because of the little fact that we had not changed, it was quite all right, quite easy, just the same as when we had dined together in restaurants. I was comfortable in my stockinette dress. I laughed and talked about things we had seen in Italy and France. We even had the snapshots on the table, and Frith and the footman were impersonal people, as the waiters had been. They did not stare at me, as Mrs. Danvers had done. We sat in the library after dinner, and presently the curtains were drawn and more logs thrown on the fire. It was cool for May. I was thankful for the warmth that came from the steady burning logs. It was new for us to sit together like this after dinner, for in Italy we had wandered about, walked or driven, gone into little cafes, leant over bridges. Maxim made instinctively now for the chair on the left of the open fireplace and stretched out his hand for the papers. He settled one of the broad cushions behind his head and lit a cigarette. This is his routine, I thought. This is what he always does. This has been his custom now for years. He did not look at me. He went on reading his paper, contented, comfortable, having assumed his way of living, the master of his house. And as I sat there, brooding, my chin in my hands, fondling the soft ears of one of the spaniels, it came to me that I was not the first one to lounge there in possession of the chair. Someone had been before me, and surely left an imprint of her person on the cushions and on the arm where her hand had rested. Another one had poured the coffee from the same silver coffee pot, had placed the cup to her lips, had bent down to the dog, even as I was doing. Unconsciously, I shivered, as though someone had opened the door behind me and let a draught into the room. I was sitting in Rebecca's chair. I was leaning against Rebecca's cushion. And the dog had come to me and laid his head upon my knee, because that had been his custom, and he remembered, in the past, she had given sugar to him there. Chapter 8. I had never realized, of course, that life at Manderley would be so orderly and planned. I remember now, looking back, how on that first morning Maxim was up and dressed and writing letters even before breakfast, and when I got downstairs, rather after 9 o'clock, a little flurried by the booming summons of the gong, I found he had nearly finished. He was already peeling his fruit. He looked up at me and smiled. "You mustn't mind," he said. "This is something you will have to get used to. I've no time to hang about at this hour of the day. Running a place like Manderley, you know, is a full-time job. The coffee and the hot dishes are on the sideboard. We always help ourselves at breakfast." I said something about my clock being slow, about having been too long in the bath, but he did not listen. He was looking down at a letter, frowning at something. How impressed I was, I remember well, impressed and a little overawed by the magnificence of the breakfast offered to us. There was tea in a great silver urn, and coffee too, and on the heater, piping hot dishes of scrambled eggs, of bacon, and another of fish. There was a little clutch of boiled eggs as well in their own special heater, and porridge in a silver porringer. On another sideboard was a ham, a great piece of cold bacon. There were scones, too, on the table, and toast and various pots of jam, marmalade and honey, while dessert dishes, piled high with fruit, stood at either end. It seemed strange to me that Maxim, who in Italy and France had eaten a croissant and fruit only and drunk a cup of coffee, should sit down to this breakfast at home, enough for a dozen people, day after day, probably, year after year, seeing nothing ridiculous about it, nothing wasteful. I noticed he had eaten a small piece of fish. I took a boiled egg. And I wondered what happened to the rest. All those scrambled eggs, that crisp bacon, the porridge, the remains of the fish. Were there menials, I wondered, whom I should never know, never see, waiting behind kitchen doors for the gift of our breakfast? Or was it all thrown away, shoveled into dustbins? I would never know, of course. I would never dare to ask.
"Thank the Lord, I haven't a great crowd of relations to inflict upon you," said Maxim. "A sister I very rarely see, and a grandmother who is nearly blind. Beatrice, by the way, asks herself over to lunch. I half expected she would. I suppose she wants to have a look at you."
"Today?" I said, my spirits sinking to zero.
"Yes, according to the letter I got this morning. She won't stay long. You'll like her, I think. She's very direct, believes in speaking her mind. No humbug at all. If she doesn't like you, she'll tell you so to your face."
I found this hardly comforting, and wondered if there was not some virtue in the quality of insincerity. Maxim got up from his chair and lit a cigarette.
"I've a mass of things to see to this morning. Do you think you can amuse yourself?" he said. "I'd like to have taken you round the garden, but I must see Crawley, my agent. I've been away from things too long. He'll be in to lunch, too, by the way. You don't mind, do you? You'll be all right?
Of course, I said. I shall be quite happy. Then he picked up his letters and went out of the room. And I remember thinking this was not how I imagined my first morning. I had seen us walking together, arms linked, to the sea, coming back rather late and tired and happy to a cold lunch alone, and sitting afterwards under that chestnut tree I could see from the library window. I lingered long over my first breakfast, spinning out the time, and it was not until I saw Frith come in and look at me from behind the service screen that I realized it was after 10 o'clock. I sprang to my feet at once, feeling guilty, and apologized for sitting there so late, and he bowed, saying nothing, very polite, very correct, and I caught a flicker of surprise in his eyes. I wondered if I had said the wrong thing. Perhaps it did not do to apologize. Perhaps it lowered me in his estimation. I wished I knew what to say, what to do. I wondered if he suspected, as Mrs. Danvers had done, that poise and grace and assurance were not qualities inbred in me, but were things to be acquired, painfully perhaps and slowly, costing me many bitter moments. As it was, leaving the room, I stumbled, not looking where I was going, catching my foot on the step by the door, and Frith came forward to help me, picking up my handkerchief, while Robert, the young footman who was standing behind the screen, turned away to hide his smile. I heard the murmur of their voices as I crossed the hall, and one of them laughed. Robert, I supposed. Perhaps they were laughing about me. I went upstairs again, to the privacy of my bedroom, but when I opened the door, I found the housemaids in there doing the room. One was sweeping the floor, the other dusting the dressing table. They looked at me in surprise. I quickly went out again. It could not be right, then, for me to go to my room at that hour in the morning. It was not expected of me. It broke the household routine. I crept downstairs once more, silently, thankful of my slippers that made no sound on the stone flags, and so into the library, which was chilly, the windows flung wide open, the fire laid, but not lit. I shut the windows and looked round for a box of matches. I could not find one. I wondered what I should do. I did not like to ring, but the library, so snug and warm last night with the burning logs, was like an ice-house now, in the early morning. There were matches upstairs in the bedroom, but I did not like to go for them because it would mean disturbing the housemaids at their work. I could not bear their moon faces staring at me again. I decided that when Frith and Robert had left the dining room, I would fetch the matches from the sideboard. I tiptoed out into the hall and listened. They were still clearing. I could hear the sound of voices and the movement of trays. Presently, all was silent. They must have gone through the service doors into the kitchen quarters. So I went across the hall and into the dining room once more. Yes, there was a box of matches on the sideboard, as I expected. I crossed the room quickly and picked them up. And as I did so, Frith came back into the room. I tried to cram the box furtively into my pocket, but I saw him glance at my hand in surprise. "Did you require anything, madam?" he said. "Oh, Frith," I said awkwardly, "I could not find any matches." He at once proffered me another box, handing me the cigarettes too at the same time. This was another embarrassment, for I did not smoke. "No, the fact is," I said, "I felt rather cool in the library. I suppose the weather seems chilly to me after being abroad, and I thought perhaps I would just put a match to the fire." "The fire in the library is not usually lit until the afternoon, madam," he said. "Mrs. De Winter always used the morning room. There is a good fire in there. Of course, if you should wish to have the fire in the library as well, I will give orders for it to be lit." "Oh, no," I said. "I would not dream of it. I will go into the morning room. Thank you, Frith." "You will find writing paper and pens and ink in there, madam," he said. "Mrs. De Winter always did all her correspondence and telephoning in the morning room, after breakfast. The house telephone is also there, should you wish to speak to Mrs. Danvers." "Thank you, Frith," I said. I turned away into the hall again, humming a little tune to give me an air of confidence. I could not tell him that I had never seen the morning room, that Maxim had not shown it to me the night before. I knew he was standing in the entrance to the dining room watching me as I went across the hall, and that I must make some show of knowing my way. There was a door to the left of the great staircase, and I went recklessly towards it, praying in my heart that it would take me to my goal. When I came to it and opened it, I saw that it was a garden room, a place for odds and ends. There was a table where flowers were done. There were basket chairs stacked against the wall, and a couple of Macintoshes, too, hanging on a peg. I came out a little defiantly, glancing across the hall, and saw Frith still standing there. I had not deceived him, though, not for a moment. "You go through the drawing-room to the morning-room, madam," he said. "Through the door there on your right, this side of the staircase. You go straight through the double drawing-room and turn to your left." "Thank you, Frith," I said humbly, pretending no longer. I went through the long drawing-room, as he had directed. A lovely room, this, beautifully proportioned, looking out upon the lawns down to the sea. The public would see this room, I supposed, and Frith, if he showed them round, would know the history of the pictures on the wall and the period of the furniture. It was beautiful, of course, I knew that, and those chairs and tables probably without price. But for all that, I had no wish to linger there. I could not see myself sitting ever in those chairs, standing before that carved mantelpiece, throwing books down onto the tables. It had all the formality of a room in a museum, where alcoves were roped off, and a guardian, in cloak and hat, like the guides in the French chateau, sat in a chair beside the door. I went through then, and turned to the left, and so on to the little morning room I had not seen before. I was glad to see the dogs there, sitting before the fire, and Jasper, the younger, came over to me at once, his tail wagging, and thrust his nose into my hand. The old one lifted her muzzle at my approach, and gazed in my direction with her blind eyes. But when she had sniffed the air a moment, and found I was not the one she sought, she turned her head away with a grunt, and looked steadily into the fire again. Then Jasper left me too, and settled himself by the side of his companion, licking his side. This was their routine. They knew, even as Frith had known, that the library fire was not lit until the afternoon. They came to the morning room from long custom. Somehow I guessed, before going to the window, that the room looked out upon the rhododendrons. Yes, there they were, blood-red and luscious, as I had seen them the evening before. Great bushes of them, massed beneath the open window, encroaching onto the sweep of the drive itself. There was a little clearing, too, between the bushes, like a miniature lawn, the grass a smooth carpet of moss, and in the centre of this the tiny statue of a naked faun, his pipes to his lips. The crimson rhododendrons made his background, and the clearing itself was like a little stage where he would dance and play his part. There was no musty smell about this room as there had been in the library. There were no old, well-worn chairs, no tables littered with magazines and papers, seldom, if ever, read, but left there from long custom, because Maxim's father, or even his grandfather, perhaps, had wished it so. This was a woman's room, graceful, fragile, the room of someone who had chosen every particle of furniture with great care, so that each chair, each vase, each small, infinitesimal thing should be in harmony with one another, and with her own personality. It was as though she who had arranged this room had said, "This I will have, and this, and this," taking piece by piece from the treasures in Manderley each object that pleased her best, ignoring the second rate, the mediocre, laying her hand with sure, certain instinct only upon the best. There was no intermingling of style, no confusing of period, and the result was perfection in a strange and startling way. Not coldly formal like the drawing-room shown to the public, but vividly alive, having something of the same glow and brilliance that the rhododendrons had, massed there beneath the window. And I noticed then that the rhododendrons, not content with forming their theatre on the little lawn outside the window, had been permitted to the room itself. Their great warm faces looked down upon me from the mantelpiece. They floated in a bowl upon the table by the sofa. They stood, lean and graceful, on the writing-desk beside the golden candlesticks. The room was filled with them. Even the walls took colour from them, becoming rich and glowing in the morning sun. They were the only flowers in the room, and I wondered if there was some purpose in it, whether the room had been arranged originally with this one end in view, for nowhere else in the house did the rhododendrons obtrude. There were flowers in the dining room, flowers in the library, but orderly and trim, rather in the background. Not like this. Not in profusion. I went and sat down at the writing desk, and I thought how strange it was that this room, so lovely and so rich in colour, should be at the same time so business-like and purposeful. Somehow I should have expected that a room furnished as this was, in such exquisite taste, for all the exaggeration of the flowers, would be a place of decoration only, languorous and intimate. But this writing table, beautiful as it was no pretty toy where a woman would scribble little notes, nibbling the end of a pen, leaving it day after day in carelessness, the blotter a little askew. The pigeonholes were docketed, letters unanswered, letters to keep, household, estate, menus, miscellaneous, addresses, each ticket written in that same scrawling pointed hand that I knew already. And it shocked me, even startled me to recognize it again, for I had not seen it since I had destroyed the page from the book of poems, and I had not thought to see it again. I opened a drawer at hazard, and there was the writing once more, this time in an open leather book, whose heading, Guests at Manderley, showed at once, divided into weeks and months, what visitors had come and gone, the rooms they had used, the food they had eaten. I turned over the pages and saw that the book was a complete record of a year, so that the hostess, glancing back, would know to the day, almost to the hour, what guest had passed what night under her roof, and where he had slept, and what she had given him to eat. There was notepaper also in the drawer, thick white sheets for rough writing, and the notepaper of the house with the crest and the address, and visiting cards, ivory white, in little boxes. I took one out and looked at it, unwrapped it from its thin tissue of paper. Mrs. De Winter, it said, and in the corner, Manderley. I put it back in the box again, and shut the drawer, feeling guilty suddenly and deceitful, as though I were staying in somebody else's house, and my hostess had said to me, "Yes, of course, write letters at my desk," and I had unforgivably, in a stealthy manner, peeped at her correspondence. At any moment she might come back into the room, and she would see me there, sitting before her open drawer, which I had no right to touch. And when the telephone rang suddenly, alarmingly, on the desk in front of me, my heart leapt, and I started up in terror, thinking I had been discovered. I took the receiver off with trembling hands, and, "Who is it?" I said. "Who do you want?" There was a strange buzzing at the end of the line, and then a voice came, low and rather harsh, whether that of a woman or a man I could not tell, and, "Mrs. De Winter," it said. "Mrs. De Winter." "I'm afraid you've made a mistake," I said. "Mrs. De Winter has been dead for over a year." I sat there, waiting, staring stupidly into the mouthpiece, and it was not until the name was repeated again, the voice incredulous, slightly raised, that I became aware, with a rush of colour to my face, that I had blundered irretrievably, and could not take back my words. "It's Mrs. Danvers, madam," said the voice. "I'm speaking to you on the house telephone." My faux pas was so palpably obvious, so idiotic and unpardonable, that to ignore it would show me to be an even greater fool, if possible, than I was already. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Danvers," I said, stammering, my words tumbling over one another. The telephone startled me. I didn't know what I was saying. I didn't realize the call was for me, and I never noticed I was speaking on the house telephone. "I'm sorry to have disturbed you, madam," she said. "And she knows," I thought. "She guesses I have been looking through the desk." "I only wondered whether you wished to see me, and whether you approved of the menus for today." "Oh," I said, "oh, I'm sure I do. That is, I'm sure I approve of the menus. Just order what you like, Mrs. Danvers. You needn't bother to ask me."
"It would be better, I think, if you read the list," continued the voice. "You will find the menu of the day on the blotter beside you."
I searched feverishly about me on the desk, and found at last a sheet of paper I had not noticed before. I glanced hurriedly through it. Curried prawns, roast veal, asparagus,
cold chocolate mousse. Was this lunch or dinner? I could not see. Lunch, I suppose.
"Yes, Mrs. Danvers," I said. "Very suitable. Very nice indeed."
"If you wish anything changed, please say so," she answered, "and I will give orders at once. You will notice I have left a blank space beside the sauce for you to mark your preference. I was not sure what sauce you are used to having served with the roast veal. Mrs. de Winter was most particular about her sauces, and I always had to refer to her."
"Oh," I said. "Oh, well, let me see, Mrs. Danvers. I hardly know. I think we had better have what you usually have, whatever you think Mrs. de Winter would have ordered."
"You have no preference, madam?"
"No," I said. "No, really, Mrs. Danvers. I rather think Mrs. de Winter would have ordered a wine sauce, madam." "We will have the same, then, of course," I said.
"I'm very sorry I disturbed you while you were writing, madam."
"You didn't disturb me at all," I said. "Please don't apologize."
"The post leaves at midday, and Robert will come for your letters and stamp them himself," she said. "All you have to do is ring through to him on the telephone if you have anything urgent to be sent, and he will give orders for them to be taken into the post office immediately."
"Thank you, Mrs. Danvers," I said. I listened for a moment, but she said no more, and then I heard a little click at the end of the telephone, which meant she had replaced the receiver. I did the same. Then I looked down again at the desk, and the notepaper, ready for use, upon the blotter. In front of me stared the ticketed pigeonholes, and the words upon them, letters unanswered, estate, miscellaneous, were like a reproach to me for my idleness. She who sat here before me had not wasted her time as I was doing. She had reached out for the house telephone and given her orders for the day swiftly, efficiently, and run her pencils perhaps through an item in the menu that had not pleased her. She had not said, "Yes, Mrs. Danvers, and of course Mrs. Danvers," as I had done. And then, when she had finished, she began her letters, 5, 6, 7 perhaps, to be answered, all written in that same curious, slanting hand I knew so well. She would tear off sheet after sheet of that smooth white paper, using it extravagantly because of the long strokes she made when she wrote. And at the end of each of her personal letters, she put her signature, Rebecca, that tall, sloping R, dwarfing its fellows. I drummed with my fingers on the desk. The pigeonholes were empty now. There were no letters unanswered waiting to be dealt with, no bills to pay that I knew anything about. If I had anything urgent, Mrs. Danvers said I must telephone through to Robert and he would give orders for it to be taken to the post. I wondered how many urgent letters Rebecca used to write, and who they were written to. Dressmakers, perhaps. I must have the white satin on Tuesday without fail, or to her hairdresser. I shall be coming up next Friday and want an appointment at 3 o'clock with Monsieur Antoine himself. Shampoo, massage, set, and manicure. No, letters of that type would be a waste of time. She would have a call put through to London. Frith would do it. Frith would say, "I am speaking for Mrs. de Winter." I went on drumming with my fingers on the desk. I could think of nobody to write to. Only Mrs. Van Hopper. And there was something foolish, rather ironical, in the realization that here I was, sitting at my own desk, in my own home, with nothing better to do than to write a letter to Mrs. Van Hopper, a woman I disliked, whom I should never see again. I pulled a sheet of notepaper towards me. I took up the narrow, slender pen with the bright, pointed nib. "Dear Mrs. Van Hopper," I began. And as I wrote, in halting, laboured fashion, saying I hoped the voyage had been good, that she had found her daughter better, that the weather in New York was fine and warm, I noticed for the first time how cramped and unformed was my own handwriting. Without individuality, without style, uneducated even, the writing of an indifferent pupil taught in a second-rate school. Chapter 9. When I heard the sound of the car in the drive, I got up in sudden panic, glancing at the clock, for I knew that it meant Beatrice and her husband had arrived. It was only just gone 12. They were much earlier than I expected, and Maxim was not back yet. I wondered if it would be possible to hide, to get out of the window into the garden, so that Frith,
Bringing them to the morning room would say, "Madam must have gone out," and it would seem quite natural. They would take it as a matter of course. The dogs looked up inquiringly as I ran to the window, and Jasper followed me, wagging his tail. The window opened out onto the terrace and the little grass clearing beyond, but as I prepared to brush past the rhododendrons, the sound of voices came close, and I backed again into the room. They were coming to the house by way of the garden, Frith having told them doubtless that I was in the morning room. I went quickly into the big drawing room and made for a door near me on the left. It led into a long stone passage, and I ran along it, fully aware of my stupidity, despising myself for this sudden attack of nerves. But I knew I could not face these people, not for a moment, anyway. The passage seemed to be taking me to the back regions, and as I turned a corner, coming upon another staircase, I met a servant I had not seen before, a scullery maid, perhaps. She carried a mop and pail in her hands. She stared at me in wonder, as though I were a vision, unexpected in this part of the house. And, "Good morning," I said, in great confusion, making for the stairway. "And good morning, madam," she returned, her mouth open, her round eyes inquisitive as I climbed the stairs. They would lead me, I supposed, to the bedrooms, and I could find my suite in the east wing, and sit up there a little while, until I judged it nearly time for lunch, when good manners would compel me to come down again. I must have lost my bearings, for passing through a door at the head of the stairs, I came to a long corridor that I had not seen before, similar in some ways to the one in the east wing, but broader and darker. Dark, owing to the panelling of the walls. I hesitated, then turned left, coming upon a broad landing and another staircase. It was very quiet and dark. No one was about. If there had been housemaids here during the morning, they had finished their work by now and gone downstairs. There was no trace of their presence, no lingering dust smell of carpets lately swept, and I thought, as I stood there, wondering which way to turn, that the silence was unusual, holding something of the same oppression as an empty house does when the owners have gone away. I opened a door at hazard and found a room in total darkness, no chink of light coming through the closed shutters, while I could see dimly in the centre of the room the outline of furniture swathed in white dust sheets. The room smelt close and stale, the smell of a room seldom, if ever, used, whose ornaments are herded together in the centre of a bed and left there covered with a sheet. It might be, too, that the curtain had not been drawn from the window since some preceding summer, and if one crossed there now and pulled them aside, opening the creaking shutters, a dead moth who had been imprisoned behind them for many months would fall to the carpet and lie there, beside a forgotten pin and a dried leaf, blown there before the windows were closed for the last time. I shut the door softly and went uncertainly along the corridor, flanked on either side by doors, all of them closed, until I came to a little alcove set in an outside wall where a broad window gave me light at last. I looked out, and I saw below me the smooth grass lawn stretching to the sea, and the sea itself, bright green with white-tipped crests, whipped by a westerly wind and scudding from the shore. It was closer than I had thought, much closer. It ran surely beneath that little knot of trees below the lawns, barely 5 minutes away, and if I listened now, my ear to the window, I could hear the surf breaking on the shores of some little bay I could not see. I knew then I had made the circuit of the house and was standing in the corridor of the west wing. Yes, Mrs. Danvers was right. You could hear the sea from here. You might imagine in the winter it would creep up onto those green lawns and threaten the house itself, for even now, because of the high wind, there was a mist upon the window glass, as though someone had breathed upon it. A mist, salt-laden, borne upwards from the sea. A hurrying cloud hid the sun for a moment as I watched, and the sea changed colour instantly, becoming black, and the white crests with them, very pitiless suddenly, and cruel. Not the gay, sparkling sea I had looked on first. Somehow, I was glad my rooms were in the east wing. I preferred the rose garden, after all, to the sound of the sea. I went back to the landing then, at the head of the stairs,
and as I prepared to go down, one hand upon the banister, I heard the door behind me open, and it was Mrs. Danvers. We stared at one another for a moment without speaking, and I could not be certain whether it was anger I read in her eyes or curiosity, for her face became a mask directly she saw me. Although she said nothing, I felt guilty and ashamed, as though I had been caught trespassing, and I felt the telltale colour come up into my face. "I lost my way," I said. "I was trying to find my room."
"You have come to the opposite side of the house," she said. "This is the west wing."
"Yes, I know," I said.
"Did you go into any of the rooms?" she asked me.
"No," I said. "No, I just opened a door. I did not go in." "Everything was dark, covered up in dust sheets. I'm sorry, I did not mean to disturb anything. I expect you like to keep all this shut up."
"If you wish to open up the rooms, I will have it done," she said. "You have only to tell me. The rooms are all furnished and can be used."
"Oh, no," I said. "No, I did not mean you to think that."
"Perhaps you would like me to show you all over the West Wing," she said. I shook my head.
"No, I'd rather not," I said. "No, I must go downstairs." I began to walk down the stairs, and she came with me by my side, as though she were a warder, and I in custody.
"Any time when you have nothing to do, you have only to ask me, and I will show you the rooms in the West Wing," she persisted, making me vaguely uncomfortable. I knew not why. Her insistence struck a chord in my memory, reminding me of a visit to a friend's house as a child, when the daughter of the house, older than me, took my arm and whispered in my ear, "I know where there is a book locked in a cupboard in my mother's bedroom. Shall we go and look at it?" I remembered her white, excited face and her small, beady eyes, and the way she kept pinching my arm.
"I will have the dust sheets removed, and then you can see the rooms as they looked when they were used," said Mrs. Danvers. "I would have shown you this morning, but I believed you to be writing letters in the morning room. You have only to telephone through to my room, you know, when you want me. It would only take a short while to have the rooms in readiness."
We had come down the short flight of stairs, and she opened another door, standing aside for me to pass through, her dark eyes questing my face. "It's very kind of you, Mrs. Danvers," I said. "I will let you know sometime." We passed out together onto the landing beyond, and I saw we were at the head of the main staircase now, behind the minstrel's gallery.
"I wonder how you came to miss your way," she said. "The door through the west wing is very different to this."
"I did not come this way," I said.
"Then you must have come up the back way, from the stone passage," she said.
"Yes," I said, not meeting her eyes. "Yes, I came through a stone passage." She went on looking at me, as though she expected me to tell her why I left the morning room in sudden panic, going through the back regions, and I felt suddenly that she knew, that she must have watched me, that she had seen me wandering perhaps in that west wing from the first, her eye to a crack in the door.
"Mrs. Lacey and Major Lacey have been here some time," she said. "I heard their car drive up shortly after 12.
"Oh," I said. "I had not realized that."
"Frith will have taken them to the morning room," she said. "It must be getting on for 12:30. You know your way now, don't you?"
"Yes, Mrs. Danvers," I said, and I went down the big stairway into the hall, knowing she was standing there above me, her eyes watching me. I knew I must go back now to the morning room and meet Maxim's sister and her husband. I could not hide in my bedroom now. As I went into the drawing-room, I glanced back over my shoulder, and I saw Mrs. Danvers still standing there at the head of the stairs, like a black sentinel. I stood for a moment outside the morning-room, with my hand on the door, listening to the hum of voices. Maxim had returned then, while I had been upstairs, bringing his agent with him, I supposed, for it sounded to me as if the room was full of people. I was aware of the same feeling of sick uncertainty I had experienced so often as a child, when summoned to shake hands with visitors, and turning the handle of the door, I blundered in to be met at once, it seemed, with a sea of faces and a general silence.
"Here she is at last," said Maxim. "Where have you been hiding? We were thinking of sending out a search party. Here is Beatrice, and this is Giles, and this is Frank Crawley. Look out, you nearly trod on the dog.
Beatrice was tall, broad-shouldered, very handsome, very much like Maxim about the eyes and jaw, but not as smart as I had expected. Much tweedier, the sort of person who would nurse dogs through distemper, know about horses, shoot well. She did not kiss me. She shook hands very firmly, looking me straight in the eyes, and then turned to Maxim.
"Quite different from what I expected. Doesn't answer to your description at all."
Everyone laughed, and I joined in, not quite certain if the laugh was against me or not, wondering secretly what it was she had expected, and what had been Maxim's description.
"And this is Giles," said Maxim, prodding my arm, and Giles stretched out an enormous paw and wrung my hand, squeezing the fingers limp, genial eyes smiling from behind horn-rimmed glasses.
"Frank Crawley," said Maxim, and I turned to the agent, a colourless, rather thin man with a prominent Adam's apple, in whose eyes I read relief as he looked upon me. I wondered why, but I had no time to think of that, because Frith had come in and was offering me sherry, and Beatrice was talking to me again.
"Maxim tells me you only got back last night. I'd not realised that, or of course we would never have thrust ourselves upon you so soon. Well, what do you think of Manderley?"
"I scarcely seen anything of it yet," I answered. "It's beautiful, of course." She was looking me up and down, as I had expected, but in a direct, straightforward fashion, not maliciously like Mrs. Danvers, not with unfriendliness. She had a right to judge me. She was Maxim's sister, and Maxim himself came to my side now, putting his arm through mine, giving me confidence.
"You're looking better, old man," she said to him, her head on one side, considering him. "You've lost that fine drawn look, thank goodness. I suppose we've got you to thank for that," nodding at me. "I'm always very fit," said Maxim shortly. "Never had anything wrong with me in my life. You imagine everyone ill who doesn't look as fat as Giles."
"Bosh," said Beatrice. "You know perfectly well. You were a perfect wreck 6 months ago. Gave me the fright of my life when I came and saw you. I thought you were in for a breakdown. Giles, bear me out. Didn't Maxim look perfectly ghastly last time we came over? And didn't I say he was heading for a breakdown?"
"Well, I must say, old chap, you're looking a different person," said Giles. "Very good thing you went away. Doesn't he look well, Crawley?"
I could tell by the tightening of Maxim's muscles under my arm that he was trying to keep his temper. For some reason, this talk about his health was not welcome to him, angered him even, and I thought it tactless of Beatrice to harp upon it in this way, making so big a point of it. "Maxim's very sunburnt," I said shyly. "It hides a multitude of sins. You should have seen him in Venice, having breakfast on the balcony, trying to get brown on purpose. He thinks it makes him better looking." Everyone laughed, and Mr. Crawley said, "It must have been wonderful in Venice, Mrs. De Winter, this time of year." "And yes," I said, "we had really wonderful weather. Only one bad day, wasn't it, Maxim?" The conversation drawing away happily from his health, and so to Italy, safest of subjects, and the blessed topic of fine weather. The conversation was easy now, no longer an effort. Maxim and Giles and Beatrice were discussing the running of Maxim's car, and Mr. Crawley was asking if it were true that there were no more gondolas in the canals now, only motorboats. I don't think he would have cared at all had there been steamers at anchor in the Grand Canal. He was saying this to help me. It was his contribution to the little effort of steering the talk away from Maxim's health, and I was grateful to him, feeling him an ally for all his dull appearance.
"Jasper wants exercise," said Beatrice, stirring the dog with her foot. "He's getting much too fat, and he's barely 2 years old. What do you feed him on, Maxim?"
"My dear Beatrice, he has exactly the same routine as your dog," said Maxim. "Don't show off and make out you know more about animals than I do."
"Dear old boy, how can you pretend to know what Jasper's been fed on when you've been away for a couple of months? Don't tell me Frith walks to the lodge gates with him twice a day. This dog hasn't had a run for weeks, I can tell by the condition of his coat."
"I'd rather he looked colossal than half-starved like that half-wit dog of yours," said Maxim.
"Not a very intelligent remark when Lion won 2 firsts at Crufts last February," said Beatrice.
The atmosphere was becoming rather strained again, I could tell by the narrow lines of Maxim's mouth, and I wondered if brothers and sisters always sparred like this,
making it uncomfortable for those who listened. I wished that Frith would come in and announce lunch, or would we be summoned by a booming gong? I did not know what happened at Manderley. "How far away from us are you?" I asked, sitting down by Beatrice. "Did you have to make a very early start?"
"We're 50 miles away, my dear, in the next county, the other side of Trochester. The hunting's so much better with us. You must come over and stay when Maxim can spare you. Giles will mount you."
I'm afraid I don't hunt, I confessed. I learnt to ride as a child, but very feebly. I don't remember much about it.
"Well, you must take it up again," she said. "You can't possibly live in the country and not ride. You wouldn't know what to do with yourself. Maxim says you paint. That's very nice, of course, but there's no exercise in it, is there? All very well on a wet day when there's nothing better to do."
"My dear Beatrice, we are not all such fresh-air fiends as you," said Maxim.
"I wasn't talking to you, old boy. We all know you're perfectly happy slopping about the Manderley Gardens and never breaking out of a slow walk."
I'm very fond of walking, too," I said swiftly. "I'm sure I shall never get tired of rambling about Manderley, and I can bathe, too, when it's warmer."
"My dear, you are an optimist," said Beatrice. "I can hardly ever remember bathing here. The water's far too cold, and the beach is shingle."
"I don't mind that," I said. "I love bathing, as long as the currents are not too strong. Is the bathing safe in the bay?" Nobody answered, and I realized suddenly what I had said. My heart thumped, and I felt my cheeks go flaming red. I bent down to stroke Jasper's ear in an agony of confusion.
"Jasper could do with a swim and get some of that fat off," said Beatrice, breaking the pause. "But he'd find it a bit too much for him in the bay, wouldn't you, Jasper? Good old Jasper, nice old man."
We patted the dog together, not looking at one another.
"I say, I'm getting infernally hungry. What on earth is happening to lunch?" said Maxim.
"It's only just on one now," said Mr. Crawley, according to the clock on the mantelpiece.
"That clock was always fast," said Beatrice.
"It's kept perfect time now for months," said Maxim. At that moment the door opened and Frith announced that luncheon was served.
"I say, I must have a wash," said Giles, looking at his hands.
We all got up and wandered through the drawing-room to the hall in great relief, Beatrice and I a little ahead of the men, she taking my arm.
"Dear old Frith," she said. "He always looks exactly the same and makes me feel like a girl again. You know, don't mind me saying so, but you're even younger than I expected. Maxim told me your age, but you're an absolute child. Tell me, are you very much in love with him?"
I was not prepared for this question, and she might have seen the surprise in my face, for she laughed lightly and squeezed my arm.
"Don't answer," she said. "I can see what you feel. I'm an interfering bore, aren't I? You mustn't mind me. I'm devoted to Maxim, you know, though we always bicker like cat and dog when we meet. I congratulate you again on his looks. We were all very worried about him this time last year, but of course you know the whole story."
We had come to the dining room by now, and she said no more, for the servants were there and the others had joined us. But as I sat down and unfolded my napkin, I wondered what Beatrice would say did she realize that I knew nothing of that preceding year, no details of the tragedy that had happened down there in the bay, that Maxim kept these things to himself, that I questioned him never. Lunch passed off better than I dared to hope. There were few arguments, or perhaps Beatrice was exercising tact at last. At any rate, she and Maxim chattered about matters concerning Manderley, her horses, the garden, mutual friends, and Frank Crawley, on my left, kept up an easy patter with me, for which I was grateful, as it required no effort. Giles was more concerned with food than with the conversation, though now and again he remembered my existence and flung me a remark at hazard.
"Same cook, I suppose, Maxim," he said, when Robert had offered him the cold soufflé for the second time. "I always tell B. Manderley is the only place left in England where one can get decent cooking. I remember this soufflé of old."
"I think we change cooks periodically," said Maxim. "But the standard of cooking remains the same. Mrs. Danvers has all the recipes. She tells them what to do."
"Amazing woman, that Mrs. Danvers," said Giles, turning to me. "Don't you think so?"
"Oh, yes," I said. "Mrs. Danvers seems to be a wonderful person."
"She's no oil painting, though, is she?" said Giles,
and he roared with laughter. Frank Crawley said nothing, and looking up I saw Beatrice watching me. She turned away then and began talking to Maxim. "Do you play golf at all, Mrs. de Winter?" said Mr. Crawley. "No, I'm afraid I don't," I answered. glad that the subject had been changed again, that Mrs. Danvers was forgotten. And even though I was no player, knew nothing of the game, I was prepared to listen to him as long as he pleased. There was something solid and safe and dull about golf. It could not bring us into any difficulties. We had cheese and coffee, and I wondered whether I was supposed to make a move. I kept looking at Maxim, but he gave no sign, and then Giles embarked upon a story rather difficult to follow about digging a car out of a snowdrift. What had started the train of thought I could not tell, and I listened to him politely, nodding my head now and again and smiling, aware of Maxim becoming restive at his end of the table. At last he paused, and I caught Maxim's eye. He frowned very slightly and jerked his head towards the door. I got up at once, shaking the table clumsily as I moved my chair, and upsetting Giles's glass of port. "Oh, dear," I said, hovering, wondering what to do, reaching ineffectively for my napkin. "But all right, Frith will deal with it," said Maxim. "Don't add to the confusion. Beatrice, take her out in the garden. She's scarcely seen the place yet." He looked tired, rather jaded. I began to wish none of them had come. They had spoiled our day, anyway. It was too much of an effort just as we returned. I felt tired, too, tired and depressed. Maxim had seemed almost irritable when he suggested we should go into the garden. What a fool I had been upsetting that glass of port. We went out onto the terrace and walked down onto the smooth green lawns. "I think it's a pity you came back to Manderley so soon," said Beatrice. "It would have been far better to potter about in Italy for 3 or 4 months and then come back in the middle of the summer. Done Maxim a power of good, too, besides being easier from your point of view. I can't help feeling it's going to be rather a strain here for you at first." "Oh, I don't think so," I said. "I know I shall come to love Manderley." She did not answer, and we strolled backwards and forwards on the lawns. "Tell me a bit about yourself," she said at last. "What was it you were doing in the south of France?" "Living with some appalling American woman," Maxim said. I explained about Mrs. Van Hopper and what had led to it, and she seemed sympathetic but a little vague, as though she was thinking of something else. "Yes," she said when I paused. "It all happened very suddenly, as you say. But, of course, we were all delighted, my dear, and I do hope you will be happy." "Thank you, Beatrice," I said. "Thank you very much." I wondered why she said she hoped we would be happy, instead of saying she knew we would be so. She was kind, she was sincere. I liked her very much, but there was a tiny doubt in her voice that made me afraid. "When Maxim wrote and told me," she went on, taking my arm, "and said he had discovered you in the south of France and you were very young, very pretty, I must admit it gave me a bit of a shock. Of course, we all expected a social butterfly, very modern and plastered with paint. The sort of girl you expected to meet in those sort of places. When you came into the morning room before lunch, you could have knocked me down with a feather." She laughed, and I laughed with her. But she did not say whether or not she was disappointed in my appearance, or relieved. "Poor Maxim," she said. "He went through a ghastly time, and let's hope you've made him forget about it. Of course he adores Manderley." Part of me wanted her to continue her train of thought, to tell me more of the past, naturally and easily like this. And something else, way back in my mind, did not want to know, did not want to hear. "We're not a bit alike, you know," she said. "Our characters are poles apart. I show everything on my face, whether I like people or not, whether I'm angry or pleased. There's no reserve about me. Maxim is entirely different, very quiet, very reserved. You never know what's going on in that funny mind of his. I lose my temper on the slightest provocation, flare up, and then it's all over. Maxim loses his temper once or twice in a year, and when he does, my God, he does lose it. I don't suppose he ever will with you. I think you're a placid little thing." She smiled and pinched my arm, and I thought about being placid. How quiet and comfortable it sounded. Someone with knitting on her lap, with calm, unruffled brow. Someone who was never anxious, never tortured by doubt and indecision. Someone who never stood as I did, hopeful, eager, frightened, tearing at bitten nails, uncertain which way to go, what star to follow. "You won't mind me saying so, will you?" she went on, "but I think you ought to do something to your hair. Why don't you have it waved? It's so very lanky, isn't it, like that? Must look awful under a hat. Why don't you sweep it back behind your ears?" I did so obediently, and waited for her approval. She looked at me critically, her head on one side. No, she said. No, I think that's worse. It's too severe and doesn't suit you. No, all you need is a wave, just to pinch it up. I never have cared for that Joan of Arc business, or whatever they call it. What does Maxim say? Does he think it suits you?
I don't know, I said. He's never mentioned it.
Oh, well, she said, perhaps he likes it. Don't go by me. Tell me, did you get any clothes in London or Paris?
No, I said.